Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
A lot of rock and roll musicians will tell you there's just something about a guitar. In a new documentary, the rock and roller Randy Bachman describes the spiritual and physical connection you can make with the instrument. You put your arms around it, he says. It can feel your heartbeat. Tyler Meesom directed the film. It's called Taking Care of Business.
You may not know the name Randy Bachman, but I am certain you know his music. Taking Care of Business. Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. These Eyes, Undone, American Woman, to just name a few. And Randy, he had this guitar, and it was his favorite guitar. It was Dumbo's Feather. It was Roy Hobbs' Bat. It was this totemistic way that he created music. And he had that Gretsch. It's a 1957 orange Gretsch, and it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful guitars of all time, in my opinion. And he bought it when he was 14 with his own money, and it made him a musician. It made him a rock star. And he loved it. You know, he carried it with him. He chained it to hotel toilets. He never let this guitar out of his sight because it was what made him a noted musician. ...1976... He's at Phase One Studios in Toronto. They're recording an album.
All the gear was out and loaded in the truck, except for my Gretsch, which I always kept with me. And the roadie came and said, I'll take your guitar, put it in the van. And I said, don't let it out of your sight. Came back a half hour later and he said, the Gretsch is gone. What do you mean it's gone? Well, I went and paid the bill to Holiday and came back. It was gone. Your life explodes. Your heart explodes. Your mind explodes. I literally felt like somebody had pulled my left arm off or my right arm off or pulled part of my heart out of me. You don't know what to do.
And that sets in a chain of motion where the band breaks up. His wife divorces him. He loses millions of dollars, and he never writes another hit again, and he spends his entire life trying to find this 1957 6120 Chet Atkins Magic Gretsch. When we started this film, I fully took the premise that this is a magic guitar, that the gods blessed him with this beautiful orange Gretsch, and it made him a rock star. But at some point, the gods pulled that guitar back. And despite him trying to find it his whole life, he never did until it came back at the right time. And I don't want to say too much because it gives away a certain twist of the movie, but it comes back not for him to make music, but to literally save his life.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Tyler Meesom's film. It's the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it tonight. We'll give you some more details here in a moment. And yes, it's about what happens when Randy Bachman loses his beloved Gretsch, how his life falls apart, how he doesn't write another hit song. But there's also a Mormon angle in here that you might find interesting. Although, really, it's mostly about the guitar. Here's Tyler Meesom again.
For a lot of people, a guitar means something to listen to. But when you're creating music, that's your tool. And every guitar is different. They sound different. They look different. They feel different. They make different noises. You use them for different sounds or different types of songs. There's a totemistic element that I think a lot of people have. I'm generalizing, but I think men especially, we have this like good luck charm. You know, we keep old baseballs around from high school or you know, our pen. I have a pen that I've carried with me since I was 18 years old. And it's stupid that I have this stupid, lucky, magic pen with me. But we have that kind of good luck charm. And for Randy Bachman, his good luck charm was the 1957 Grudge.
Yeah. So as you were working out what this film was going to be about, what came to mind? I mean, on one hand, of course, it's somewhat straightforward. This is the mystery of this missing guitar of this rock and roll star. But there's so much else in the film. There are a lot of things here. How do you describe how it evolved and what you think it's about now?
You know, if somebody would have come to me and say, hey, Tyler, make a documentary about Randy Bachman. You know, he was a guitarist and kind of a part of a lead singing group for Bachman Turner Overdrive and the Guess Who. I'd probably say, probably not. But there were so many elements of this story that weren't necessarily about the music. When this came to me, it came to me through an email. Tal Bachman, who was in the film, sent an email to my producer, Rick Krim, who is a longtime music producer, and he was one of the MTV founders, really great guy. And he forwarded it to me. And look, I get emails all the time. I get people saying, you should make a documentary about this, you should make a documentary about that. And 9 out of 10, 95 out of 100, I actually just say, it's not that great, or I don't have the time, or the market's not there. I read that email, and I didn't even get through the end of it before I said, I'm going to make this movie.
Wow. And we should say Tal is Randy's son.
Tal is Randy's son. And he has an element of the story as well. Mm-hmm. So there were so many layers to this film. And it was very much in my wheelhouse as far as the films I've made. Now, it's funny because I said, yes, I'm going to do this film. And then I went to bed. And the next day I woke up and I was like, oh, my God, that's right. Randy Bachman is a Mormon. I had totally forgotten that Randy Bachman and Tal Bachman, his son, his whole family were Mormon. And I was like, yeah, that's still another of my storylines of the work I've done. So
there's this funny moment when Randy, you're talking to Randy, you're interviewing him, and there he is for the interview, and he wants to jump forward and get to the point where he loses the guitar, and you're like, whoa, hold on a minute. That to me sort of conveyed the fact that it's not just about the losing of the guitar, it's about his faith, it's about his family. There's more to it than just this guitar.
We all know the Mormon community, we know the Mormon world. I was raised as a Mormon, and when you're a Mormon, it's first and foremost. And it's one thing to be a Mormon and be a dentist. It's another thing wholly altogether to be a Mormon in the hedonistic rock and roll, sex, drugs, and rock and roll era of the 1970s. I mean, you're talking about the 70s when rock stars were titans. They walked the earth as gods among men. And they were Zeppelin and The Who and Pink Floyd and these heavy partying, drug-taking musicians. And that was part of the lifestyle. And here's a guy who had huge hits and was a teetotaling Mormon. Yeah. And he would be on the road for 250 days a year, and then he'd try and be a father. And look, we're fathers. I understand, you know, how difficult it is to be a career man and a father at the same time, and how Randy had to do that. And that's really the dichotomy I was really interested in. And that's something that you don't see in most rock and roll documentaries, frankly. You see that, oh, we made it, it was great, and then drugs kicked in, and we were in trouble, and we fought, and then we got back together. This was more about how to be a family man and a father. And that leads through the whole film and is part of the climax of it, with his kind of reuniting of his guitar and with his family in some aspects.
How does Randy Bachman come to have this guitar, this Gretsch?
So, 1957, he wanted to be a musician. He was raised. He was growing up in Winnipeg, and he saw a Gretsch, 1957, 6120. And if you can look it up, it's really beautiful. It's hollow body. It's really a gorgeous guitar, and he saw it in the window of the Winnipeg piano store. And oddly enough, and this isn't in the film, but he grew up friends with Neil Young.
Yeah.
And him and Neil were like battling to see who could get that guitar first.
I had a little paper route that would pay me, I don't know, $3 a week. And I bought that Gretsch for $400. I was just so hungry to play the guitar. I would play for hours and hours. In bed, I'd fall asleep with it, wake up with it. Play again. I failed grade 10. I failed grade 11. I was skipping too much school. And when exams came, my mother took the guitar away from me and hid it. So I went and phoned the police. Do you have any idea who took it? Yeah, her. I never let it out of my sight again. It wasn't even called my guitar. It was called my Gretsch.
What is so special about a 6120? And in particular, the 1950s. Like, what is so special about that guitar?
I kind of ascribe the guitar to Randy in some aspects. It's large. It's bulky. I mean, it's beautiful, but it's not a Pete Townsend slam the guitar into the amps.
Yeah.
It was a big kind of hollow body that would actually go out of tune quite a bit. And it's hard to take on the road. It's heavy. It's unwieldy. You know, in the 70s, in the late 60s and 70s, rock stars started to use like Fender Strats, which, I mean, you can beat the hell out of a you can beat the hell out of a Fender Strat. And we've seen it. You know, we've seen Roger Daltrey smash Fender Strats into amps. And then you can pick it up and still play My Generation on it, but not the 6120 Gretsch. It's more finger picking guitar, and it's Randy Bachman, albeit a quote unquote rock star. He's one of the most unrock stars of rock stars. You know, he definitely doesn't dress like it. He doesn't party like it. He doesn't look like it. He's kind of chunky and, you know, kind of boring in some ways. And every night after a show, he'd go back to his hotel room. He loved going into a Holiday Inn. Like he wanted a Holiday Inn because he knew where every single thing was. Yeah. Like, I know where the that's what a salesman does, not a rock star. Rock stars tear hotels apart. So that guitar really kind of was Randy in some aspects.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how he comes to find Mormonism. He wasn't born Mormon. It comes through his wife. He meets a woman named Lorraine. Tell us about the meet cute.
The things we've done for love, right? He was on tour. He was with the Guess Who, and they'd had a hit by that point, Shaken All Over. Maybe they had another, but he was on tour and he went into a coffee shop. Oddly enough, Joni Mitchell was playing in this coffee shop.
Whoa.
And he wanted to see, I know, right? We didn't put it in the movie, but he went to see a young Joni Mitchell, who's also from Canada. And he sees this beautiful woman. And with the strains of Joni Mitchell playing, who wouldn't fall in love, right? Yeah. And he sees this beautiful woman and he asks her out. And they start to date. And then he finds out that she's Mormon.
Thing about Lorraine, when she said to me, I'm a Mormon, I didn't know what that was.
We'd like you to meet the Mormon.
God has a work for you, Joseph. There is a book deposited, written upon gold plates.
Well, we don't drink or smoke. Fine, I don't drink or smoke. We go to church every Sunday. Fine. We don't drink caffeine. I hate coffee. I never drank coffee in my life. Will you abide by these rules? Yeah, I already do. So for me, it was a normal thing to do to be in that church structure. Let's live happily ever after. Bing, I'm in. And we got married 6 months later.
And he became a very ardent Mormon. Hmm. He held callings. As you know, the Mormon community likes to hold up anyone who has, you know, any level of fame. In some ways, it normalizes them. But he was very much used by the Mormon faith as a, look, this guy can be a rock star and still be a Mormon. He was a Mormon for many, 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 many years of his life.
Yeah. You know, another part of the story I think is really great is that we hear Randy telling the origin story of some of these kind of iconic rock songs. Talk about the story of creating American Woman. I think the context here is interesting. I mean, they're playing the U.S. when the Vietnam War is raging, so there aren't a lot of young men to compete with in these audiences. And he just talks about the magic of something coming to you. I liked this part of the film.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit in Randy's career, you know, and I'm a big believer as an artist. I'm a big believer in the muse. I do believe that the muse can come down and tap you on the shoulder and give you the gift of song or film or poetry. However, it doesn't come for anyone. You know, as Stephen King says in his great book, the muse isn't some fairy. It's an angry cigar-smoking man who doesn't want to help you, but he will if he knows you're sitting at a keyboard between the hours of 10 and 2 every day. He will help you. And with Randy, he throughout his career, he had this gift of like this muse creating music for him in a setting that's, you know, in front of individuals. Mm. And with American Woman, and this is one of my favorite moments in the film, because he's literally shows us how he's tuning his guitar. He breaks a string on stage. He puts a new string in. The band takes a break. And he starts tuning it up, and he's tuning it bow, 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 bow.
Tuning up that one string. And I look up, and everybody's head who was talking has snapped towards the stage. And I go, oh, my God, I can't forget this riff. And I keep playing it, and I see Gary Peterson. I go like this. He comes up and starts playing drums. Jim Keel comes up and starts playing bass. I said, just follow me, follow me. Burton runs on stage. He goes, what is this? I yell to him, sing something. He just screamed out, American Woman, stay away from me.
American Woman. And oddly enough is that they had someone in the audience with a tape deck recording that session. A couple months later, they were in the studio and they found that tape and they recorded that song, and it's become an anthem.
Yeah.
That's an anthem.
You know, it's interesting. Randy says that moment of, I don't know, inspiration. He says it's like being hit with an arrow.
Yeah.
And it's either that feeling, it's like it can be love, but it can also be the magic of creation.
Right.
And we hear a lot of that. I think that As you said, the idea of finding a muse, or the idea of inspiration, the ineffable quality of that—that's seems like a really important part of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And being open to that magic in some ways, being ready to accept that bolt of lightning that may come, and being on stage at the time and not blocking it, and accepting it. And you know, he talks about how somebody said to him, "Hey, buddy, it's no big deal. Let it ride." And what happens? Yeah. He writes the song, Let It Ride. So just being open to that kind of magic that comes is a big part of the film, because magic happens in Randy's life as he gets older.
Tyler Meesom, his new documentary is called Taken Care of Business, which we're going to be screening tonight at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details at RadioWest.org. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a decent number of these stories where famous rock musicians lose their instruments. Jimmy Page had his Les Paul Custom stolen. Bob Dylan left his Fender Stratocaster on a plane. And for years, no one was quite sure what happened to Paul McCartney's Hofner bass. But no one was as devastated about losing their guitar as when Randy Bachman lost his 1957 Gretsch 6120. And this is the story at the center of Tyler Meesom's latest film. It's called Taken Care of Business, and it's the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it tonight at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. So the Guess Who are really big. They're a big deal. They start having hits, and then this conflict emerges. A couple of things are sort of going on. One is he's in a rock band, but he's also a Mormon. Now, as you said, he's kind of naturally not – he's kind of stays away from a lot of that stuff anyway. But he – you know, he's not drinking. He's not into the pot. And he's kind of a – buzzkill to the other guys, right? I mean, that seems like an important part of it. And then the other part of the story is it's the conflict that you explore in the film between him being a father and a family man and being a rock and roller. and being on the road constantly. So talk about that part.
You know, rock stardom is interesting, and today's rock stars are not the rock stars of old. Rock stars now, they exercise. They get up.
Yeah, they have trainers.
Smoothies. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in the 70s, I mean, that was part of being a rock star. What would the Stones do is what most bands would say. You party. And that was part of it. That was part of the identity of being a rock and roll band, was partying. And here's the lead, not the lead singer, but essentially the lead guitarist of this band, Randy Bachman, who didn't party and would not only not party, but would nag the other guys about it. Go to bed, guys. We got to get up. You know, he'd knock on their doors, time to go to bed, and they'd have to hide their partying from him. And for a band like the Guess who, God, I don't remember what year it was, 72, 71 maybe, they had a number one hit and a number one album. They were above Let It Be, for goodness sakes. And there's Randy Bachman, who just wants to be home with his kids, who missed his children's birth, who can't be a father.
You come home and you rush to pick up your child, and they look at you and they cry. They are only 8 months old, one-tenth of their life that you've been away, they don't know who you are. And you're going, dada, dada, and they realize you're dada, and you're there for 4 or 5 days or a week, and you get to know the child gets to know you, then you go away again. People think that being in a rock and roll band is a glamorous thing. Well, the glamour is about 2 hours on stage. And after that, you're alone with your guitar. You're alone with a bunch of guys who you can't stand because you've been on the road with them for 60 days. They're sick of you, and all you want to do is go home. And it's an endurance test.
He was on the road all the time, and he just didn't want to do it anymore. And the band essentially kicked him out. They just said, fine, we'll go on without you. And they did. And they found two other guitarists to take his place.
There's a great clip in the film with one of the guys in Guess Who, Barton Cummings, who he's talking about how Randy was just like dragging down the vibe of the band. Like, they're on top of the world, and he just wanted to be back home.
Yeah. And these guys wanted a party. I mean, no one wants a wet blanket, especially when you're 22 years old and you're playing rock and roll for beautiful women and you're allowed to do whatever you want. You have money. Like, it's hard. How Randy did that, I don't know. But it was definitely not something that the rest of the band wanted anymore.
It's interesting. They didn't part well. Like, it seemed like it got kind of ugly, and there's a moment we hear where the members of the band are being interviewed, and they don't want to talk about Randy. Like, did they hate him? Like, what was that about?
At that point, yeah, it got really ugly, and it got public, and it got ugly, and it got legal, and it got rights to the name Guess Who, and rights to the music, and it got very, very ugly. And Randy just kind of left, and it became very... I mean, look, the Guess Who was the first real rock band from Canada. They were the first real big band. Yeah. And so they were in the press. And everyone kind of turned on Randy Bachman. He left the Guess Who. Keep making music, Randy. And they hated him for it. Canada hated him for it. And what he tried to do was, he said, I want to make music that's very un-Guess Who. Oddly enough, he started a little band. He wanted to do like a Crosby, Stills, and Nash thing. And he started a band. God, I don't even remember what it was called. Oddly enough, I think it's not in the film, but it just tanked. No one wanted to hear him play folk music. So he kind of had to stay at home for a little bit. And then he started Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Yeah. Say something about, though, the last gig with the Guess Who. Because it's kind of a nice moment. It's a story that you relate in the film where they go back to like that kind of first big hit, These Eyes, which has a cool backstory too that you tell in the film.
And that's a beautiful song. You know, when they decided to break up, they had one more show to play, and it was the Fillmore East, the famed venue in New York City. And Randy had a stomach ulcer, and he said he felt so much pain that he said it was like taking a drug. He said, I was like high. We'll be right back.
I'm doing triple solos, and I'm playing like Clapton and Hendrix, and the band is looking at me, and we get encore after encore, and at the end, Burton Cummings says, "We have nothing left to play," and somebody yells out, "Play These Eyes!" And they all put their arm around each other and start singing. All these hippies, who are all Stonerama, right? This is their high school graduation song. This is their song that they played at dances and stuff. And so we play These Eyes as our final song, and it's pretty amazing.
It's one of the renowned moments of rock and roll, and I've heard about this. And that was it. And then there's a famous photo that's in the film that they took, the last photo they took of the Guess Who. And who knows what could have happened with the Guess Who after that. They could have been a very big band, or could have self-destructed. I don't know. Regardless, Randy went on, as did the Guess Who. They kept playing and had some fine hits.
So everyone's angry with Randy. He leaves this incredibly important band. He, as you said, he tries to do something a little bit more acoustic, maybe more sedate. Doesn't work, as you say. And then he creates another great rock band, Bachman Turner Overdrive. I think you could argue, which do you think is more successful? It seems like BTO.
Is, yeah,
right?
Unquestioned. Yeah, I mean, yeah. That was stadium rock. That was, I mean, Taking Care of Business, you know, that song, you can't turn on the bloody television without hearing that in a commercial. You can't hear I Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. It's just like these are huge songs. And this was at a time when musicians actually made money. You know, now it's not as much. You could sell an album back then, and they did. They sold millions and millions of albums, and they're getting X amount per album and X amount per show. And they had huge hits, and Randy unquestionably became a millionaire in 1970s, mid-70s.
Tell the origin story of Taking Care of Business. That's another good story in the film.
It was when he was with the Guess Who, and he was in a studio. And there was a guy who would come to the studio every day, and he was very professional looking. He had a white and button-down shirt and a sport coat. And he asked him, he said, when do you come into work? And he says, oh, I come into work. I take the 8:15 into the city. And Randy wrote a song called White Collar Worker, which was kind of an honor of him. And it would go, you know, white collar worker. And the Guess Who hated it, and rightfully so. He wanted it to, they said it sounded too much like the Beatles, oddly enough. And it probably did. And then one day he's playing with BTO, and their lead singer couldn't sing. They'd played too often. And they said, Randy, you're going to have to sing. Now, Randy did sing some songs, but I wouldn't put Randy as a singer by any means. Right. He just, you know, the band members, the singers he had, Burton Cummings has one of the greatest voices of all time, the Guess Who. Right. I mean, those pipes he has are remarkable. And Fred Turner, man, what a voice. Fred Turner has this like Harley Davidson deep screaming voice. And Fred
looks
said,
like a Viking.
Totally. They all look like Vikings. Yeah. They all look
they
big, huge, big, huge, like fat. I mean, the joke was they were called Bachman Turner Overweight. Was the joke. But yeah, they didn't look like rock stars, actually. And then he said, Randy, you're going to have to sing this one.
And on the way to the gig that night.
Be fun. This is Daryl B, and we're taking care of business.
And I go, oh, follow me three chords. Same lyrics. The band is looking around. They've only heard white collar worker. Lightning bolts, like power. And the same magic of American Woman of putting this together. Working overtime, work out. Not in my living room, but on stage with people going crazy and dancing.
That song becomes a massive hit.
And when we recorded, I didn't use any other guitar but that orange Gretsch.
So let's talk about the Mormonism angle a little bit more. What did, when he joins, I mean, he falls in love with a Mormon girl, so he becomes Mormon. Made sense. He was not opposed to it. It seemed to make sense for him. What did he know about it? And how all in was he? Because as you said before, he seemed like he was all in for a while.
Oh, yeah. I don't think he knew much about it before, but I'm certain he had two young, fresh-faced men in shirts and ties sit down and give him the lessons. And as his son Tal said, he more joined because he was in love with, as Tal said, my mother.
Yeah.
Tal says he would have joined the Church of Satan if she was that member.
Right.
Because he wanted to be with his mother so badly. But he was a full-fledged Mormon. In fact, when he started PTO, he wanted to make sure that no one in the band smoked or drank. That was the rule. You can't smoke or drink in order to be in my band.
What can you say about Lorraine, his wife? I think she's this kind of mysterious figure in the film. She's not in the film beyond some clips, as you say. What do you want to say about this part of the story?
Well, as I mentioned before, Randy, after he lost the guitar, his world kind of fell apart. And he had built this multi-million-dollar home and a huge home, a big, huge, massive elevator, swimming pool, indoor home.
Yeah. He kind of goes crazy.
A little crazy. Yeah. And I think it's more her. And I think it's, frankly, her way of just saying, like, yeah, you're going to be on the road. Well, I'm going to be at home putting, he mentions gold taps in the bathrooms. Yeah. And he was just getting further and further away. And I think at some point, she's got six kids, man. You know what I mean? That is rough. And, Mormon women are kind of meant to be the homemakers. But I mean, I have seven sisters. I have five sisters and one brother. While my mother was the homemaker, my dad, most unquestioned, pitched in and helped out and was there for us all the time. Randy wasn't. He was on the road 250 days a year, and then he'd come home and he'd have to leave. So I think they just got further and further and further apart. And one day she just called him and said, "Don't come home.
I
want a divorce." And it really bewilders Randy. And it kind of bewilders the kids. And trust me, I have asked and tried to figure out why. What did he do? What was it? Women don't just divorce their husbands because they want to play rock and roll. Mm. And no one knows. Randy doesn't know. Tal doesn't know. She just kind of left. And in a very un-1970s style, kind of loses custody of the kids and leaves them with Randy. And Randy, now, who spent his entire life on the road, now has to stay home and be a father to six kids. And this is quite a turn in the movie when he now takes care of children instead of takes care of business, I guess.
I was awarded full custody of all six children. And then I get a call from Carl Wilson to come and play on a Beach Boys album. And I have to say to him, "Carl, I can't come. If I leave now, my ex is going to go to the judge and I'd lose the kids. I've got to be a dad. I got up in the morning. I did their lunch."
"Here we go into our kitchen. Here's Madame Benoit. Here we go outside."
"They went to school. At 10 o'clock, I zoomed to my studio."
"You all set?"
"Yeah, ready.
I worked till 2 o'clock. I came home at 3 in the afternoon."
"Hi, Kevin." "Hi, Brigham. How much are you earning for that job?" "Great, you're being overpaid."
"Music was my therapy, and my kids were my big love. And I did that for years. A really good formative years for me and them. It really bonded us, made us very close."
There was something that I wondered about. One of his kids mentioned that his mother started referring to the rock and roll that Randy was playing as devil's music.
Yeah.
How much did the faith influence her disaffection with all of that, if you can even say?
I don't necessarily know other than what they've said, but the children will say that it grew them further and further apart was the music. Yeah. And, I'd hardly think that "Ain't Seen Nothing Yet" is devil's music, frankly. It is very far from "Let It Ride" is not Iron Maiden by any means. So I don't really know what it was. And then she just up and kind of disappeared. And frankly, his wife now, Tal doesn't even know. He thinks she lives in Sweden somewhere and she's gone uber religious. So we weren't even able to talk to her.
Wow. Tal says something interesting. He says that he didn't think his father's real faith was in any church. It was in that guitar.
Yeah.
Do you think that's right?
I think the guitar represented making music for him. And he put a lot into that guitar. When he was 14 years old, I'm going to buy a guitar and it's going to make me a famous musician. And when it does, you put your faith in that guitar. I think it's a little oversimplistic to say that that was his religion, because he was a teetotaling true blue Mormon. But that guitar was very important to him. You know, he really thinks that when he lost that guitar, his career went down the hill. And I can't say that it didn't. I'm not going to say that it's not. I mean, it was 1976. What I will say is that, you know, 3 years later, we saw MTV and we wanted, you know, the Police and Culture Club, not, you know, big, heavy, bearded rock
chubby
and
rock and roll.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, so yeah, he kind of fell out of fashion in that way. But he never stopped making music, obviously.
So Tal, his son, features in the story in the sense that he has this kind of he has success, kind of minor success for has his moment, I guess we can put it that way, in the music scene.
Yeah, that is a story that I absolutely loved, and we initially didn't have it in the film, and it felt kind of like cramming it in, but ultimately we made it work because Tal went on a Mormon mission, and Tal was, I've known some very strict Mormons. Tal was, from what I know, the most strict Mormon I've ever known in my life. Tal Bachman was insanely ardent and he was a baptizing machine. And he came home from his mission and he wanted to try his hand at music.
Yeah.
And he comes up with a demo and no one wants it. Nobody wants it. And then one day, almost like his father, he writes a song, a very, very simple song, and he literally records it in an hour and a half. He puts the demo in an envelope. He sends it off to Rick Krim, oddly enough, my producer. And Rick, who worked at Sony at the time, signed him to a deal. And the song was She's So High. And that was a very big song in the 90s. Now, the funny thing is that the record label wanted to drop that song. They called it a teaser. They just wanted to, like, tease the track. She's So High was going to be like the, hey, this is a guy named Tal Bachman. It'll play for a month or two. And then they were going to release a song called If You Sleep, which is a great song. And the song She's So High just kept being played over and over and over and over. And for a year, that was a radio favorite. She's so high.
My next guest is from Canada. High above
me. That song just kind of took on a life of its own. High above me. But my fear levels being corrupted by being a musician were off the charts. Every song I would write, I would just think to myself, you know, is this a good example for the church? It's very difficult to be creative when you're thinking that way. Within a year and a half, I'd been dropped.
And look, man, how many bands are out there, like, or tried to be bands in the 80s and 90s and 70s, hundreds of thousands. And to just have a record deal, that is a very rare accomplishment. So, and I'll tell you, She's So High is a great song, man. It really is. It is a very singable song.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much you want to talk about the sort of loss of faith part of the story. I don't want to give everything away. Tal, as you said, has this intense conflict between his music and his faith, but he starts to lose his faith, and Randy starts to lose it too, probably through Tal, I guess it's fair to say. What do you want to say about that part of the story?
Yeah, Randy, Tal is one of these individuals that, again, he was such a Mormon, he was so studious, and he went so deep into the theology and the backstory and the history of the faith that he really started to find some disparities. And honestly, he told me it three or four times, and I still don't understand what it was that really made him go, that's, you know, for me, it's like, oh, polygamy, I don't like that. That doesn't seem right to me. For him, it's just like this really odd, obscure reasoning. And it was quite a struggle for him to leave this faith. I mean, he wanted to be a general authority. Like, that's what he wanted to be. And one day, he just gives his father a letter, and it lays out a couple of things. And his father, Randy Bachman, who lived his life as a Mormon, who became a rock star as a Mormon, who broke up the Guess Who because he was a Mormon, reads it and then calls up and says, well, I guess we've been had. And that was it. And that was it. Just like that. No, just turned it off completely and no longer went to church.
Tyler Meesom, his new film is Taking Care of Business, and you can join us to see it tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. You can get details at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Tyler Meesom. Tonight, we're going to be screening his latest film at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. It's called Taking Care of Business. Let's talk about the search for the Gretsch, because it's an important part, of course, obviously, of the story. And there's a great character, this kind of nebbish internet sleuth that you find that is determined to find the Gretsch. Tell us about William Long.
So when Randy lost this Gretsch, he searched for it. I mean, he spent years and years. He hired detectives. He reached out to all kinds of pawn shops, magazines. He put ads in papers. He really tried to find his guitar. And he never could. But what he could do is he wanted to find the same magic in other Gretsches. So he quite literally bought over 300 Gretsch guitars, trying to replicate that same magic, and never could. He had a room in his house that was the Gretsch room, and he never could find that same magic. And he just kept looking and kept looking and kept looking. And as the kid said, it just became this idyllic item that he was always looking for and always wanted to find. And then in 2020, during the pandemic, we were all doing weird things with our time. This odd internet sleuth in Canada watched a video about Randy talking about his guitar and said, I can find that guitar. If it's on the internet, I can find it, because there was a flaw. There was a couple of flaws in the guitar, in the wood grain. Metaphor? Maybe. And he searches the internet for this guitar.
It wasn't just Googling Orange Gretsch. It took me like a month to get the spelling. I always spelt it wrong without the S. I don't know why that S is there. Completely unnecessary. I was using all kinds of different keywords, changing the language, searched all through North America. The UK, England, Germany, boom, boom, boom. Searched all over the world. And finally, this image popped up on the vintage guitar shop in Tokyo. The fingerprints just match perfectly. It's undeniable. I found it. I said it wrong. I forgot about my wife there. Okay, hang on. Because I said to her, I found it. And she said, let's buy it. But it was sold.
Some kooky Japanese rockabilly musician had purchased it in a vintage guitar shop not but a few years prior.
Yeah.
And they connect. And there's a beautiful, touching scene in the film where they have a Zoom. And Randy gets to see his magic Gretsch for the first time in 40-something years.
That's great. He's super emotional. What's interesting about it, though, is, as you say, this Japanese musician, who we won't – I don't think we need to say too much more. Again, this is a great part of the film. But he has his own relationship with his guitar, right? Like, he talks about believing that guitars have auras. When he went in to buy this Gretsch that ended up being the stolen guitar of Randy Bachman, there were other vintage guitars that were great, but he picked this one because it had this kind of history embedded in it. And as he said, he figured he could learn a lot from the guitar. So I think this is so interesting because he's just not some person who has some vague interest in a guitar. He connects to it kind of in the same way Randy Bachman does.
It's difficult for me to say that an energy is ascribed to an item, to an inanimate object. But I can't say that it wouldn't be. Right. I can't say that this guitar didn't soak up some of that energy and music that Randy gave to it, and the love that he gave to it over the course of decades. And that emanates in some way. A guitar is a piece of wood and string and steel and metal, but it's not a hammer. You know, it's a tool, but it's not a hammer. It makes art, and it makes beautiful music, and it makes people happy. And for Takeshi, who's the Japanese musician, when he finds this guitar, he says, I felt something in this guitar. I felt it. And I knew that this guitar had come all the way from the United States just for me. And so he buys it.
The moment when Takeshi, he doesn't want to give this up. He sort of confesses to you, but he's preparing to do it. He knows it's sort of the right thing to do, I guess. But there's this moment when he does, and there is this question that Randy asks, which I found really compelling. He says, I suppose there's some chance. It seemed like there was some chance that maybe this isn't the right one. Like, even though he sort of knows that it is, we think that's the right one. It has the flaw. But it's like he won't know until he plays it right. Or is with it, right. I guess.
Well, I think he knows that it's the same guitar. He just doesn't know if the magic is there.
Right.
He won't know if that magic is part of it.
Yeah.
And Randy genuinely believes and still does. He believed then. Now, mind you, I came into this film right after he'd found the guitar. And fortunately, other people had been shooting. Like his daughter-in-law, Coco, had been shooting some footage and filming what had been happening and actually filming the moment when they met with Takeshi. But I came in right after he found it. And so Randy genuinely believes that once he gets his guitar back, he will have the magic back and he will write another hit.
You know, there is one thing that sort of may come up for people. It was like, okay, you lost your guitar, but you have a room full of, you know, over the course of these many years he mentions, he buys like 300 Gretches. Just move on. And it seems like this is a kind of a thing, you know, famous musicians losing their guitars or instruments. I mean, for years, Paul McCartney didn't know what had happened to his Hofner bass. Mm-hmm. You know, George Harrison lost track of his guitar that Eric Clapton gave him named Lucy that was really special.
Yeah, Peter Frampton lost his guitar and found it. A plane, an amazing story of Peter Frampton losing his guitar, went down in a plane. And then decades later, he gets it back. Roseanne Cash lost her guitar that her father had given her. There's countless stories of these individuals with these guitars that they love, losing them and then trying to find them over the course of decades. And it may not be that way with every musician. I know musicians, and I've kind of gotten into the musician world lately because I'm making another film about rock stars. And, you know, there are guys with 50 guitars, and there's not one that's special. There's not one that's important. It's just a tool. It's a hammer I use to hang drywall. But for some, they have a special guitar. And 9 times out of 10, it's because it's an early guitar. It's one of the first ones they had.
His daughter says that one of the lessons she thinks to the story is don't close your heart. Yeah. What do you think she means?
I think he could have easily given up hope that he could be a musician again, that he could find the guitar. And he never did. He just never gave up that dream that I will get this guitar back. And, you know, as you'll find out in the movie, it came back at the right time. And, you know, there was an issue we had with the film where he really wanted it to be about making music. I'm getting this guitar back to make music. And I think that's a bit selfish. You know, I think the guitar came back to save his life. And also for us to make this movie. And for some oddball musician in Japan to now have a movie that's playing in Salt Lake City. You know, there's these weird connections. And mind you, we also don't know what happened to that guitar between the years of 1976 to 2000.
Well, that is the question. Like, what we don't know?
No, no idea. Zero idea. No idea. There's no clues. Nothing. I suspect maybe at some point, when this film comes out, someone will watch it and go, oh, my God, I got to find that picture of me with the Gretsch of my guitar, my garage band from 82.
Yeah.
And we'll know a little bit more. But right now, no, nothing.
How's Randy these days?
Oh, he's healthy as an ox. It's unbelievable. You know, there's something to be said for not partying, drinking in the 70s. He's still making music. He's still on tour. Dude will play, you know, 14 shows in 20 days and just loves making music. And he loves this film. He's very happy with it. We premiered the Toronto International Film Festival and Tal and Randy came out and played the Magic Gretsch.
Tyler Meesom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Tyler Meesom, his new film is Taking Care of Business, which we're going to be screening tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll get started at 7 o'clock. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get more details at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER90.1, on Instagram at Radio West. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.